Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his dying days, in 1977, the great Vladimir Nabokov, creator of Lolita, lay in a hospital in Switzerland working fitfully to complete another book before his own life ran out. Death came first. Nabokov had left instructions to his wife Vera that his unfinished manuscript should be destroyed. She disobeyed. Now, years later, his son Dmitri has disobeyed him as well, and brought out of a Swiss vault what its publisher calls a novel in fragments. This hour, On Point, the last work of Vladimir Nabokov, the original of Laura. You can join the conversation. What do you think of publishing, of reading Deathbed Nabokov? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Philadelphia is Brian Boyd, preeminent Nabokov biographer and scholar. He teaches at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. He's the author of numerous books on Nabokov, including Nabokov's Pale Fire, The Magic of Artistic Discovery. His most recent book is On the Origin of Stories, Evolution, Cognition, and Fiction. Brian Boyd, it's wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for being here today.
It's great to be here, Tom.
And joining me here in the studio is Leland de la Durantay. He teaches Nabokov at Harvard and is the author of Style is Matter, The Moral Art of Vladimir Nabokov. Leland, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
So here we are. Brian Boyd, you saw this, as I understand it, before it really came out of the vault. Be good enough to tell us the story of this pile of 138 note cards, now sort of bound in a very unusual book. What was Vladimir Nabokov up to, and for how long before his death? Was it really absolutely plain in his instructions that this should never be published?
No, he told Vera that he made Vera promise to destroy the manuscript. He had left an instruction on his previous novel, Look at the Harlequins, which he finished in 1974. To be destroyed unread if uncompleted. So it wasn't the first time he'd done this, and I guess he must have felt death encroaching. But he had the idea for the original of Laura from as early as 1973, so 4 years before his death, although he couldn't get to it for another year because he was finishing Look at the Harlequins, couldn't get to it for almost another year because he was finishing a translation of Ada into French because the French translator understandably had broken down and he felt obliged to fill in for the translator, and that rather exhausted him. Just after he recovered from that and was ready to go on the novel, he had a terrible fall and he was hospitalized for some time and was discovered to have a benign adenoma which was removed. It took a while to recover from that. Then in 1976, or the end of 75, beginning of 76, he was really starting to get going on it. But then he lapsed into an undiagnosed infection in the summer of 76. And he has this wonderful passage to the New York Times, who had asked what he was reading over the summer. He says he was reading a new translation of Dante, a new book on American butterflies, mm-hmm. and he was reading out aloud to an audience that consisted of his dead parents, peacocks, pigeons, crouching nurses and doctors, the text of the original of Laura, which he had in his head. But he never really recovered strength to do very much work on it. He was suffering from even worse insomnia than he'd had for the rest of his life. And so when I first read it in 87, I was knowing that he'd been working on it. Well, he'd had it in his mind for 4 years, and in about 15 months before his death, he'd said he was halfway through. I was surprised and disappointed how little there was.
And so now we're presented with what's being called a novel in fragments. Leland de la Durantay, there's a lot of sort of astonishing things about this. One, I'd never given a thought to how a writer like Nabokov, late in his life, may have been composing his work. And here he is scribbling, well, it's pretty neat, but nevertheless kind of scribbling on little index cards. They're actually published along with the text of the five chapters and fragments here and there that remain.
I guess because he envisioned the entire story, the entire novel, more or less in his mind, and then wrote segments as they came to him, and he could shuffle, shuffle the deck of these index cards to, or would have, to ultimately come up with the final form that he was happy with.
Indeed. The index cards became an ideal solution for his manner, or an ideal response to his manner of composition, which was, just as you described, for every one of his works, early or late, he said that they came to him in a flash of inspiration. And they came complete. He had the complete idea of the work in his head. He just then had to put it down on paper. That first moment of inspiration was instantaneous. What followed took a long time. Because it was complete in his mind, he felt under no compulsion to compose chronologically. He said it was a lot like painting. Sometimes you'd work on this corner of the canvas, sometimes you'd work on another.
Whenever this scene or that came to this or that came to him.
Exactly. And so the note cards were a way for him to work in a non-sequential manner on the manuscript. And in fact, he did it for all of his later manuscripts. So that was one of the reasons he had such a horror of uncompleted works. The image was complete in his mind. He knew what he was doing. He just had to get enough time to put it down on paper.
And someone else might shuffle these cards off in a way that didn't match up with what he had in mind, I suppose.
It's possible. He shuffled them around quite a bit himself. It was often something like a canvas. He knew where they went, sort of in the larger structure of the novel. But sometimes he did indeed shuffle them around, which the format of this new edition allows one to do, to remove facsimiles of every one of the note cards and then move them around, sort of play Nabokov, if you like.
Brian, if you don't mind, just drawing you a
please.
Book.
Yes, 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 exactly. I've seen the story of the original of Laura described in so many different ways. I mean, because it's a fragment, it's not that straightforward to say exactly what this is about. But if you were to distill it for our listeners, Brian Boyd, how would you do it?
Well, there are two main strands. One is Flora, who is presumably the original of a kiss-and-tell novel called either My Laura or Laura. It's described. It's referred to both ways. Who is rabidly promiscuous, deliciously unlikable, she's married to a much older man. She's 24, so it's not a Lolita situation. She's married to Philip Wilde, who's a famous psychologist and also independently wealthy, which is the fame and the fortune are the two reasons why she married him.
And grossly fat, Nabokov tells us.
Yes, just absolutely rotund and with tiny feet underneath. Tiny feet with ingrown toenails. And he's obsessed with trying to play at his own death, to kind of, by the force of mind, erase himself from the feet upwards, the feet he detests, and the great belly he detests, in a way that, in a kind of hypnotrance, as it's called, or auto-hypnosis, so that he can have, this is a phrase from another Nabokov novel, relief from the itch of being, and then when he gets to a certain point, he can relax it and come back to life, down towards his toes again. So he talks about it as self-deletion, self-erasion, and so on.
Leland, could you read a little just from early in the book? Is there a bit that you might... Or Brian, I think you've got a reading.
That's right, yeah.
There's a party. Flora is there. You're extravagantly promiscuous, Flora. Could you just dive in to give us a flavor of the text?
Well, dive in is right, because one of the amazing things about the way this is written is that it's just so fast. And this is the very beginning of the novel, and it kind of knocks you off your feet with the speed of the story. And if you
oh, please,
hear...
Dive in. We just got a couple of minutes before break here, so plunge in if you would.
Her husband, she answered, was a writer too, at least after a fashion. Fat men beat their wives, it is said, and he certainly looked fierce when he caught her riffling through his papers. He pretended to slam down a marble paperweight and crush this weak little hand, displaying the little hand in febrile motion. Actually, she was searching for a silly business letter and not in the least trying to decipher his mysterious manuscript. Oh, no, it was not a work of fiction which one dashes off, you know, to make money. It was a mad neurologist's testament, a kind of poisonous opus, as in that film. It had cost him, and would still cost him, years of toil, but the thing was, of course, an absolute secret. If she mentioned it at all, she added, it was because she was drunk. She wished to be taken home, or preferably to some cool, quiet place with a clean bed and room service. She wore a strapless gown and slippers of black velvet. Her bare insteps were as white as her young shoulders. The party seemed to have degenerated into a lot of sober eyes, staring at her with nasty compassion from every corner, every cushion and ashtray, and even from the hills of the spring night framed in the open French window. Mrs. Carr, her hostess, repeated what a pity it was that Philip could not come, or rather, that Flora could not have induced him to come. "I'll drug him next time," said Flora, rummaging all around her seat for a small, formless vanity bag, a blind black puppy. "Here it is," cried an anonymous girl, squatting quickly.
And there we are, from Vladimir Nabokov's Dying Lips, or Index Cards anyway, to our ears. And you hear that absolutely singular use of language right away. What it all adds up to, we'll come back after a short break and really look at. It's a fragment, but it's been brought out in a very substantial, hefty form with perforated index cards actually built into this new book that you can tear out and rearrange if you like. The original of Laura, Vladimir Nabokov's final work, Almost. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Vladimir Nabokov's last book, Almost, the original of Laura, just published from fragments left behind on note cards as he died. Brian Boyd is with us, preeminent biographer and scholar of Nabokov. Leland de la Durantaye is with us as well, teaches Nabokov at Harvard, author of Style is Matter. Brian Boyd, author of many big books, Vladimir Nabokov, The Russian Years, Vladimir Nabokov, The American Years, and right on down, really, at the top of scholarship on this great, great writer. And now, big fat book out from a skinny little pile of note cards, more or less against his instructions. Let's listen just for a moment to the man himself. Here's Nabokov in 1959 being interviewed on Canadian television on a program called Close Up about his controversial 1955 book of the 12-year-old Lolita and the much older Humbert Humbert. Here's the host and then the author.
Why did you choose this rather odd and something that's never been done before, this curious and debased love?
Well, I think because on the whole, it afforded me all kinds of interesting possibilities. I'm not so much interested in the philosophy of the book as I am in weaving the thing in a certain way. For instance, the systematic line of Mr. Quilty, whom Humbert will kill, and does kill, and whom Humbert mentions as early as page 33.
Vladimir Nabokov in 1959. Here is his son, Dmitri, this week in an interview with the BBC's Newsnight, saying that he didn't think he was defying his father's dying wishes in publishing the original of Laura.
I knew how he would react in a more sober and less dramatic moment if he didn't see death staring him in the face. He certainly would not have wanted to destroy it. He would have wanted to finish it.
He would have wanted to finish it, but he died. You can join us at 800-423-TALK, Leland de la Durantaye. What about it? Here it is. It's in front of us. We're reading it. We're reading from it. I don't. We'll look more at the story and at the language. It's quite marvelous, even if it's fragmentary. But what about the, I'm not sure what the right word is, etiquette, morality, you name it, of the decision to go ahead with the publishing? How do you look at it?
I think that it's important to distinguish the questions and the perspectives from which they're posed. Scholars are happy for the book. I, as a scholar, mm-hmm. I'm happy for the book. I was curious about it. I enjoyed reading it. Though, as a reader, I was disappointed because those moments of enjoyment were rare, and they were punctuated by long stretches of what was for me a sort of uneasy observation of something that not necessarily an author in decline, but an author who didn't get to polish a work as finely as he would have liked to, and for that reason doesn't hold up to his other works.
An author famous for super polishing of his work.
Absolutely. There's literally no writer of his generation, perhaps no writer of his century, who is so exacting about the precise presentation of his works. everything from the final drafts of novels to even the very interviews that he gave. He would have never appeared on your show without you having given him all the questions in advance, mm-hmm. and he would have prepared all his answers in advance. Those are the rules of engagement for his journalistic interactions. And I think that attitude toward the public presentation mm-hmm. of his private thoughts and works, against that backdrop, The Origin of Laura seems like a particular violation because he was so exacting, because he was so demanding about the presentation of things, and that calling it a novel in fragments is a very artful thing to do on the yes. part of the publisher, but it is above all the fragments of a novel. There's great editorial measures have been made to make of this, as you say, a book and a big fat book, given how very little text there is.
Because each page just has one sort of full-size version of the index card and that text beneath it, and it's only printed on every other page. So, yeah, it's a huge book off slim beginnings. Is this, Brian Boyd, you're the biographer. Do you see an offense to something essential in Nabokov here or something else?
Well, when I read it in 87, after years of pestering Vera to have access to it, she and Dmitri asked me what I thought should be done with it, and my initial reaction was destroy it, which surprised me very greatly as somebody who'd almost trembled with excitement the first time I held mm-hmm. something that Nabokov had actually written on. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'd sorted out Nabokov's archives for Vera and had reverently saved and catalogued every little scrap of envelope. And here I was saying, destroy a whole novel that nobody's read. Mm.
Because you thought the man said destroy it, so destroy it, or
partly because of that, and partly for all the reasons that most of the reviewers are disappointed by the book. I have changed my own opinion entirely and think it's a very, very interesting book and it has a lot going on. But I can understand the reactions of the reviewers. First, that it is much more fragmentary than expected. Second, that there are no sympathetic characters. Third, that The plot really seems to have broken its drive shaft. Fourth, that there's so much unpleasant sex and a reprise of the Lolita theme. And given the fact that Nabokov had played with that theme in various ways and to different extents in Pale Fire, in Ada, in Look at the Harlequins, I felt, you know, Does this make Nabokov look as though he really is himself obsessed with young girls, or is his imagination becoming exhausted so that he has to mine the same territory? And also, in Look at the Harlequins' previous novel, the central character has a problem, a mental problem that we can't really engage with, and I won't go into elaborating it, but I certainly found that a disappointing novel. And here too, Philip Wilde's attempt to erase himself, while it sounds funny and bizarre, it also is something that we go through again and again as he's trying to work out the methods and set down advice for others who might want to try the same thing. And I just felt it too unnatural. And also the prose is not like the prose of Lolita or Pale Fire or Ada. And Martin Amis, whom I appeared with in New York on Monday, when he was only in his 20s, I think it was, wrote reviewing Look at the Harlequins, that the most disappointing thing about it was the crudity of its prose.
The crudity of its prose.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Yes. He said that there were only about four passages in the whole novel that he found beautiful, whereas in an earlier Nabokov work, it would have been difficult to find that many pages that many passages that weren't.
You've turned around on almost every one of those.
That's right.
I read some of your writing on this. You've turned around on nearly each of your objections, and we'll
That's
look
right.
at that. I mean, what gave me pause was, which I had never really looked at or known, was that Leland Vera had actually stopped him earlier from burning Lolita. So it wasn't the first time that he wanted to destroy a draft. I guess we all have been the beneficiaries of her intervention that time in a way that seemed parallel.
Absolutely, and that is a parallel that would be powerful were Lolita what got saved from the incinerator that afternoon day and sometime probably in 1953 in New York. What we have is two more years of work. Actually, that would have been before 1953. Mm-hmm. It's unimportant. The important thing is that Nabokov worked for a good deal longer on what became Lolita after he was halted in his mad flight toward the incinerator. Mm-hmm. And for that, we're all grateful. But
no such time available here.
Right. And so what we have are really the bare ruined choirs of something that that might have been majestic.
We're gonna go to callers and hear some more from him. I just wanted to read a little bit. There was a wonderful review by Sam Anderson in New York Magazine. He talks about Nabokov's authorial fascism, that sort of, huge attention to detail. Most obviously a precise linguistic razzle-dazzle, he writes, that often rose to a level of Shakespeare and Joyce. Every Nabokov paragraph is a rich little stylistic Versailles, orderly cadences, exotic vocabulary, clauses nested in whimsical rows, meticulous touches of color, puzzles built out of concentric sub-puzzles, alliterative accents, perfect tropes, and right on down. Let's just bear that in mind as if you'd be good enough, then you read a bit more from the original of Laura, just out from Alfred Knopf.
Happily.
And this is, again, reading about Flora, the young, promiscuous, slender. And here we are right off the index cards as you read.
Right. So Flora, who is the titular original of Laura, as far as the mm-hmm. reader can discern, she's left a party. She's drunk. An apartment has been made available to her by one of those easygoing, overgenerous couples. She examines the fridge, looks in the bathroom, and away we go. The double bed was made, but was unfresh inside. With comic fastidiousness, Flora spread her fur coat over it before undressing and lying down. Where was the damn valise that had been brought up earlier? In the vestibule closet? Had everything to be shaken out before the pair of Morocco slippers could be located fetally folded in their zippered pouch? Hiding under the shaving kit? All the towels in the bathroom, whether pink or green, were of a thick, soggy-looking, spongy-like texture. Let us choose the smallest. On the way back, the distal edge of the right slipper lost its grip and had to be pried at the grateful heel with a finger for shoeing horn. "Oh, hurry up," she said softly. That first surrender of hers was a little sudden, if not downright unnerving. A pause for some light caresses, concealed embarrassment, feigned amusement, prefactory contemplation. She was an extravagantly slender girl. Her ribs showed. The conspicuous knobs of her hip bones framed a hollowed abdomen, so flat as to belie the notion of belly. Her exquisite bone structure immediately slipped into a novel, became, in fact, the secret structure of that novel, besides supporting a number of poems. The cup-sized breasts of that 24-year-old impatient beauty seemed a dozen years younger than she, with those pale, squinty nipples and firm form. Her painted eyelids were closed. A tear of no particular meaning gemmed the hard top of her cheek. Nobody could tell what went on in that little head.
And there we are off to the races in the original of Laura. I mean, now whether you consider that perfectly polished or not, that is Nabokov. It's fully recognizable, and it's going in so many directions, so many layers at one time. Her bone structure is suddenly the structure of a metaphor for a novel. Here it is.
Can I take issue with you there, Tom?
All right, yes, please.
You said immediately recognizable. There's a wonderful historical fact here that in 1999, for the centenary of Nabokov's birth, the oldest Nabokov journal, the Nabokovian, decided to stage a Nabokov write-alike contest.
No. Okay.
And three people were chosen as the best examples, put in the journal anonymously. Dmitri, meanwhile, announced that he was sending in a couple of passages from his father that hadn't been published. He didn't say that they were from the original of Laura, and people had to pick which was the most like Nabokov. Most people picked work by a passage by Charles Nicol, who'd been writing about Nabokov for a long time. nobody picked the two passages from the original of Laura as being by Nabokov.
Wow. So the knockoff of Nabokov did better than the actual thing?
Yeah.
We've got to look at that. What do you make of that? I mean, I'm seeing what I would think of as Nabokovian language here.
Yeah, there is. But, of course, those who were doing Nabokov write-alikes were pumping up those features. But I also think one of the things that experience has taught me, or the fact that nobody recognized the original of Laura, is that Nabokov actually, although he's got certain stylistic ticks or tricks which recur from work to work, he also modifies his style hugely from work to work, so that the nervous neuroticism of Lolita and the hyper self-conscious is very different from the kind of radiant craziness of Pale Fire or the Rococo supersaturation of Ada. Mm-hmm. And here he seems to be working with a relatively pared-down style, but one that just swoops in narrative terms around the story so fast.
Through his pneumonia and lumbago and delirium and influenza and fever in that last year or so of his life. Let's begin to bring our listeners in. Montgomery, Vermont. Diana, you're on the air, Diana.
Hi, Tom. I just have a comment after listening, and I think the only two people who could have brought this book forth would have been his wife and son. And being he was naughty in nature, I think he'd be very pleased with this, and we're able to enjoy it. We get to read it, so I think it's a good thing.
So glad that it's come. Thanks. And let me get one more. June in Newton, Massachusetts. June, you're on the air.
Yeah, I directly disagree.
Okay, let's hear it.
I side with Nabokov entirely in this, and I do this because I myself have been writing, and find that I have my beloved family who are going to try to do something with my writings after I die, and I really hate what they're doing to it.
So you want your word to be the last word, and for heaven's sakes, he's Nabokov. I mean, I don't know how exactly this sorts out through literary history, how authors' wishes have been, you know, followed or ignored. Leland, is there a pattern here? Does everyone ultimately say, well, let's publish it. There's money, there's exposure, people want to read it, let's go.
Indeed, there's a standard defense. You could call it the Virgilian defense, you could call it the Kafkan defense there. Mm-hmm. There are two very prominent precursors. The first is semi-apocryphal. Virgil spent the last 10 years of his life writing the Aeneid. On his deathbed, he felt that it was incomplete, and he asked his two closest friends to destroy it. Here, there was almost literally a deus ex machina in that Augustus intervened and, for the glory of his reign, said that it shall be published.
No less than the emperor.
Exactly. And a deified one at that. So it was published. The situation was, the case was closed.
That was that.
Kafka's was much more difficult because there was more data. He entrusted his closest friend, Max Brod, to read over his last works. He, in fact, very much wanted Brod to see the extent of his work, but the instruction was burn after reading. Kafka suffered from a sense of inadequacy and bouts of depression, especially as concerned his own writing. There was good reason for Brod to believe that that Kafka might not be thinking clearly on this matter, might wish for his writings to survive. I mean, in the event that Brod really liked them, that he could judge, he could overrule Kafka's low opinion of his own creations.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this time about Vladimir Nabokov's last book, Almost, The Original of Laura, just published from Fragments Left Behind on Note Cards as he died in 1977. Brian Boyd is with us, famed biographer and scholar of Nabokov, joins us from Philadelphia. He teaches at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, in Philadelphia with us today. And with me in the studio, Leland de la Durantay, professor of English at Harvard University, teaches on Nabokov, author of Style is Matter, The Moral Art of Vladimir Nabokov. Naughty by nature, Diana was saying in her call just before we broke, Leland?
Exactly. It's true that Nabokov was fond of practical jokes, that he was mischievous by nature, and he was especially mischievous when he was asked about his intentions in his own works. But he was deeply respectful of other people's wishes, and especially deeply respectful of other writers' situations. So I think that it would be limiting to explain or justify the publication on the basis of that Nabokov was naughty, and so that you can be turnabout as fair play. He wasn't ever naughty in this respect.
I've seen reviewers also say he was so into sort of cosmic puzzles that maybe even this, setting up a situation which would leave the inevitable struggle over whether or not to follow his instructions was somehow within his genre of a good time in Puzzle Land. I don't know. I've got a little more tape here, Brian and Leland. I'd like to play. This is Nabokov himself. This is an undated interview where he's describing what he thinks of as the great masterpieces of the 20th century, in stark and fairly contemptuous contrast to what journalists might say they are.
I have been perplexed and amused by fabricated notions about so-called great books. That, for instance, Mann's asinine Death in Venice, or Pasternak's melodramatic, vilely written Dr. Zhivago, or Faulkner's Corn Cobby Chronicles, can be considered masterpieces, or at least what journalists term great books, is to me the sort of absurd delusion as when a hypnotized person makes love to a chair. My greatest masterpieces of 20th century prose are, in this order, Joyce's Ulysses, Kafka's Transformation, Barley's Petersburg, and the first half of Proust's Fairy Tale in Search of Lost Time.
Vladimir Nabokov. Wow, what a minute of tape there, where he, you know, the asinine Death in Venice, the vilely written Dr. Zhivago, and then his own great ones. He didn't hold back there, Brian Boyd. Was that his style?
Always. He knew it was very good copy to take a crack at the greatest plaster busts, as he called
them.
That was from 1965. He was sitting on a park bench outside the Montreux Palace Hotel when he read that. It's on a TV interview, wonderful interview.
And going after journalists with their sort of absurd delusions, as when a hypnotized person makes love to a chair. Oh,
yes.
Boy. Oh, that's good. You know, I wish, just so that we can keep it in our minds, Brian, if you'd be good enough to read a little more from the original of Laura, where later in the book he's focused more on Philip Wilde, the wealthy, fat neurologist who's into, what's it called, self-annihilation. He tries to think himself away, to erase himself in a kind of trance. And there's a bit where he's thinking about that. And, of course, this as Nabokov himself was facing death.
And Philip Wilde comes back to this again and again. So we get a number of these elaborate descriptions of the process. But here's one.
Mm-hmm.
In experimenting on oneself in order to pick out the sweetest death, one cannot obviously set part of one's body on fire, or drain it of blood, or subject it to any other drastic operation, for the simple reason that these are one-way treatments. There's no resurrecting the organ one has destroyed. It's the ability to stop the experiment and return intact from the perilous journey that makes all the difference, once its mysterious technique has been mastered by the student of self-annihilation. From the preceding chapters and the footnotes to them, he's learned, I hope, how to put himself into neutral, i.e. into a harmless trance, and how to get out of it by a resolute wrench of the watchful will. What cannot be taught is the specific method of dissolving one's body, or at least part of one's body, while tranced, a deep probe of one's darkest self, the unravelling of subjective associations, may suddenly lead to the shadow of a clue, and then to the clue itself.
The only help I can provide is not even paradigmatic. For all I know, the way I found to woo death may be quite atypical. Yet the story has to be told for the sake of its strange logic. Strange being the right word.
No kidding. No, the student of self-annihilation wooing death. Wow. What do you know about how he thought of what he must have seen as his advancing death? And does this sound like some... What, his dance with death in those last months?
No, my feeling is that practically everything in the original of Laura inverts what matters to Nabokov.
Hmm.
For Nabokov, he was fascinated with the idea of death as a kind of transcendence of the self. And here's this fat Philip Wilde trying to erase himself before death. For Nabokov, that was absolutely the wrong way. What he was interested in is the possibility that the self may somehow be carried through death, and that beyond death we may be freed from what he called the solitary confinement of the self, but we would take the memories that we'd built up during the course of a lifetime into that, whatever that freer state was. And just as I think his depiction of Flora inverts everything that matters to him about love, so everything that matters to him about death and our position in the universe, I think, is inverted in Philip, even though it seems to be almost a sympathetic portrait, or at least the experiment seems to be sympathetically treated.
The great loss in death, not so much the body, but all those memories. Brennan in Gloucester, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Brennan.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was struck by the first passage that your guest read from Laura, in which the character in question was nervous that the woman would read his manuscript, and it immediately reminded me of Humbert Humbert, who had this paranoia that his diary, in which he wrote about his beloved Lolita, would be discovered. And, of course, when the diary is discovered, it drives the plot, and Miss Hayes dies, etc. But I was wondering if these reflect Nabokov's anxieties that he had about his own works being read, his own manuscripts being deciphered, so to speak.
Interesting. Brian Boyd, what do you say?
Well, Nabokov used to read at the end of the day, I think, and this is partly going on hints from Vera and from inferences from their correspondence and from details in the fiction, but it seems that when he'd got something to a state where it was shareable with another, he would read at the end of the day what he had written to Vera, and it was a very private moment, a very privileged moment, and in Pale Fire, the intrusive, insufferable neighbor Kinboat tries to eavesdrop when John Shade is reading at the end of the day to his wife, and it's just a moment that makes you squirm because he's standing on a box hedge that gives way, and he clatters upsets the garbage can and sort of course rushes off, but he's thoroughly alarmed, the Shades. Yes, clearly Nabokov felt that he had a very, very strong sense of privacy, and he also felt that one of the magic things about married love was that you could transcend the isolation of the self,
mm-hmm.
by sharing a life with another. But that precious sharing was the condition for that was that the rest of the world couldn't see. And so I think all those kinds of elements are at play here.
Of course, ultimately, Leland, he wrote to be published and was very widely and very acclaimed.
Absolutely. Just one more note or a footnote for the caller. The book, interestingly enough, as you may find it in stores, is bookended by references to manuscripts and their potential destruction. The very last note, the very last entry in the book is just a series of words: efface, expunge, erase, delete, rub out, wipe out, obliterate. And like that beginning, they can be understood as something that's referring to the condition of the manuscript you have in for you. It should have been effaced. But within the context of the novel, it also it's part of the structure of the novel. This, as Brian has detailed for us, Philip Wilde is trying to erase, to efface himself, to make dying fun, as the as he calls it.
A kind of subtitle here, and an exercise of Nabokov's himself, that mental exercise of death, as opposed to just the physical, or the opposite.
I imagine a bit of both. It obviously he was intensely ill at the time, and there was the idea of having such mental, emotional, spiritual control over oneself that the dissolution of the body is not a problem but an adventure, an exploration, is a theme running through the final notes in the novel. The degree to which that reflects personal experiences is an intangible. Or
let's listen to the man himself, the great one. This is from a French documentary. We found Nabokov in the Moment of Truth, and borrowed from an earlier interview. I'm not sure of the origin of it, but he's talking about a book he's working on at that time. It eventually became part of Ada, and he explains sort of the really hard time he's had working out the structure so that he can turn his abstract idea into a story. It gives you a sense of how Nabokov constructed his books like puzzles.
I have to devise an essay, a scholarly-looking essay on time, and then gradually turn it into the story I have in mind. The metaphors start to live. The metaphors gradually turn into the story, and my purpose is to have those metaphors breed, to form a story of their own, gradually, and then again to fall apart and it all end in this rather dry, though serious and well-meant essay on time.
Vladimir Nabokov on how he did it, how he made the puzzles of his great works come to life. Let's get a call from Concord, Massachusetts. Jale, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for this program. I'm looking forward to read this, and I believe that it's great that the book is published, because I think one literary mastery of Nabokov is very unique in the sense that he creates beauty from the most macroscopic level of choosing names and words. Then he expands it to beautiful short sentences and fantastic paragraphs. Every level, you enjoy it. And then he goes to the more macroscopic level of depiction of characters, beautifully scenery, and all the way to the grand scheme. So if the story is not completed by him, I have no problem. I would still love to read, the fragments of that.
And do you feel like a voyeur, since he's said don't publish it? Do you feel like a burglar in the night sneaking in to look through his private things, or it's not an issue for you?
Not an issue at all. I mean, he's long dead, and nothing will tarnish his well-established reputation. And it's, maybe because I don't believe so much in, I don't believe in afterlife and things like that. So
there it is. It exists. Let's read it. Jolly, we've got it. Let me get a couple more if I may. Thank you, Jolly. Florence in West Hartford, Connecticut. Florence, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom, I listen to you all the time, and I have kept journals all my life. And because he is so great, I'm reluctant to get any of my stuff published. And I feel that showing disrespect for the man, put something on and he had must have had some deep thoughts about not having it published. And I think it's lack of respect for him. I will continue to read. I will read it. I will follow it up, and maybe other people will be happy about it. I'm not unhappy about it, but I feel he did his great works. And they shouldn't be tarnished. Is it? You made a comment, Tom.
Yes.
Is it a financial thing? Is it exploitation? I hope not.
Yeah, we all hope not. We hope it's a gift. And let me get one more from me. Lee in Saranac Lake, New York. Lee, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have real problems with this. It reminds me of Hemingway, who wrote that, "I wish that none of my letters written by me during my lifetime shall be published. I accordingly direct you not to publish or consent to publish by others any such letters." Yet Mary Hemingway published his letters 15 years later. Carlos Baker edited them. Steinbeck, I think, said to Paris Review, "I'm not a great writer, but I am one of the world's great rewriters." And for Steinbeck to have had one of his draft notes published as his novel would be hugely unfair. Now, what could have been done here is this: the Nabokov novel could have been published with the title, but say, by, and then the authors being the people who put together the note cards, and then say, as constructed from notes left by Vladimir Nabokov.
Lee, let us take it in fairness. His son Dmitry writes an introduction where it's all fairly well explained, but the handwriting on the cards is Nabokov's. Brian Boyd, we've come down to just a minute here left. If you can distill your turnaround, you began with the same impulse, burn this. Now you're in the other camp. What?
Yes.
How would you distill that? That the reason for your turnaround?
Well, partly I was making that comment in 87. Mm-hmm. His reputation has had another 20-odd years to mature. Mm-hmm. It is a long time since his death now. His reputation, as one of the callers said, is absolutely secure. And just when you read it with the expectation, with looking for what is there and not thinking about what is not there, you start to see how much is going on and how much, even though it's perhaps not up to the standard he would have brought it to, is already very fine.
Very fine indeed. On 138 index cards, Leland Durantaya, last word to you. Not his highest standard, nevertheless, you'll eagerly read.
Yeah, I can only repeat what I said before. Mm. As a scholar, I'm grateful for it. As a reader, I'm disappointed by it.
Well, he can be forgiven, I guess.
Absolutely.
In those circumstances.
Unconditionally.
We're very grateful to each of you for being with us. Leland De La Durantaye from Harvard, thanks for being with us today, Leland.
My pleasure.
And Brian Boyd in Philadelphia, author of Nabokov, Vladimir Nabokov, The Russian Years, The American Years, The Magic of Artistic Discovery. Thank you so much for being with us, Brian.
It was a pleasure, too.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.